It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new state water quality standards will go into effect starting in 2025, and they'll put tighter regulations on how much phosphorus can be released from wastewater treatment plants. We'll find out how communities are trying to protect waterways from excess phosphorus and learn a little bit of the science along the way.
First, state Republicans are pushing a bill that would require health insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions. After making some last-minute tweaks, the Assembly passed a measure yesterday by a vote of 76 to 19.
Coverage of pre-existing conditions is guaranteed as part of the Affordable Care Act, but a district judge in Texas ruled last month that the entire law is unconstitutional. That decision is expected to be appealed and will likely end up at the U.S. Supreme Court.
If Obamacare is ultimately struck down, how would Wisconsin's pre-existing conditions law work? According to some industry experts, it wouldn't. Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of health care for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Guy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we talked about the bill last week, so I don't want to go through all of it, but can you give us a brief overview of what lawmakers signed off on yesterday?
What Molly and Patrick reported, the people in our Madison Bureau, is that they did add a provision that would require annual and lifetime limits on coverage. Previously, I think the bill did not have that, so that meant that insurers could have unlimited deductibles, or if you had had very high expenses, medical expenses throughout your lifetime, potentially you could be denied coverage, or they would have covered you, but you would have hit your limit. That is my understanding, but Patrick and Molly have covered that, not me.
Under this bill, nobody would have to worry about being denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition. Is that correct, or are there any loopholes?
Well, there is an important caveat to that. My understanding is the bill would not require an insurance company to provide prescription drug coverage, or, for instance, as with Medicare Part D, require insurers to have at least one or two drugs in every therapeutic class. So if I had a medical condition that requires a very high cost or expensive drug, say hepatitis C or rheumatoid arthritis, or I have hemophilia, these drugs can run tens of thousands or if not hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. If I do not have to cover those, and if I'm an insurance company, I probably would not want to cover those drugs because I would not want those people buying my health plans. You can't say these folks would have coverage without the prescription drug coverage.
How does health insurance work under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the way it works, period, in all scenarios, is, it's pooled risk. And, the issue about the bill that was passed by the Assembly is whether it would work in the real world. I mean, just passing a law saying that insurers must now cover pre-existing conditions does not mean that, a market is going to exist for those health plans. Let me rephrase that, please. A market will exist. It doesn't mean that insurers are going to sell those health plans. In states that before the ACA required insurers to cover pre-existing conditions, the market effectively collapsed. Now, New York did require coverage of pre-existing conditions before the ACA, but the market was widely considered to be a mess. And New York State is maybe the only state where premiums have actually gone down since the Affordable Care Act was passed, gone down in the individual market. And remember, we're talking here about the individual market, which is a small piece of the overall insurance market. Most folks get coverage through an employer or through Medicaid and Medicare.
So why have premiums skyrocketed under the Affordable Care Act? Is it merely the individual market? Is that driving the premiums?
Well, premiums, and this is important, premiums have skyrocketed only in the individual market. I mean, the Affordable Care Act deals mainly with the individual market. The market, you know, for health plans sold directly to individuals and families. Premiums have not skyrocketed in the market for so-called employer-sponsored insurance. The insurance that most of us get or are lucky enough to get through an employer. So to say that premiums have soared is incorrect and misleading. You hear that, it's a talking point, but where they have jumped is in the individual market.
Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of health care for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're talking about Wisconsin's pre-existing conditions law and the effects if the Affordable Care Act is struck down. And that brings me to this. If the Affordable Care Act is struck down for good, then fewer healthy people would likely be buying insurance. So what would that mean for premium costs? That would go up, correct?
Yes, and this is the real question about the bill. What insurance experts have told us, we did a story on this in December, we did a story on it this week, is without the subsidies available through the Affordable Care Act, premiums will soar. What the Affordable Care Act, the way it was designed, was by providing subsidies and requiring people to get insurance through the former mandate, the mandate or penalty that has now gone away. That was to pull healthy people into the market. Those people were needed to subsidize the cost of covering people with high medical bills, people with pre-existing health conditions. Without the subsidies, you basically have the market that existed before the ACA. And again, you know, the states that tried to do this, their market collapsed. You know, as premiums go up each year, you know, fewer and fewer, first of all, without the subsidies, a lot of people in the market right now will not be able to afford health insurance. Many of them are healthy people. The people who have health problems, medical conditions, they know they're going to have high bills. They will keep buying insurance, but there won't be this pool of people, of healthy people, to help offset the cost of covering them. Now, you know, what has happened in other states that have tried this is each year premiums will go up, insurance becomes unaffordable for more healthy people each year. People who have medical conditions have a clear incentive to continue buying insurance, and it sets off what the insurance industry calls a death spiral. And eventually, you know, what you do is you have a pool of primarily people with very high medical bills, and insurers drop out of the market.
Now, under this state bill, insurance companies, to go along with what you're saying, they would have to cover those with pre-existing conditions, and that seems that it would be a tough environment for them. Would some of them essentially just say, you know what, enough of this, we're out of here?
What experts contend is they would.
And are these scenarios largely theoretical, or have they played out in some places?
No, they have played out. They're not theoretical. Washington and Kentucky both required insurers to cover pre-existing conditions before the ACA. They did this, I believe, in the 90s. Eventually, they had to rescind that requirement because their markets essentially collapsed.
Guy, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of health care for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked with him about the state Republican bill to require health insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions and why some insurance experts say it wouldn't work if Obamacare struck down.
That bill now goes to the state Senate. Governor Tony Evers has called for additional amendments, including one that would require policies to cover what's known as essential benefits, things like maternity care for mothers and newborns, prescription drugs, and other items. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said those amendments would have been, quote, totally outside the scope of the bill.
Coming up, too much phosphorus in lakes and rivers can cause a lot of problems. We'll find out how the state's wastewater treatment plants control phosphorus and what municipalities can do to make sure that wastewater doesn't go to waste. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Senate will vote on two competing bills that would reopen the government. We'll find out where support for those bills stands during our look at the week in Washington.
Right now, too much phosphorus in our lakes and rivers can cause a lot of issues, both for aquatic life and those of us wanting to enjoy the water. And in 2025, new statewide water quality standards will go into effect, putting stricter limits on how much phosphorus can legally make it into our waterways, including from wastewater treatment plants.
That could mean treatment plants need to scale up their technology. The city of La Crosse, for example, estimates that it will need $20 million to upgrade its water wastewater facility to comply with the new rules. Municipalities around the state will need to submit their own compliance plans to the state government by next year.
Wastewater treatment might not be an everyday topic of conversation, but it's an essential service. To better understand how phosphorus can be controlled at treatment plants and elsewhere, we're joined by an expert in the field.
Trina McMahon is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering and bacteriology at UW-Madison. Trina, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard a lot here on the show, actually, about phosphorus coming from non-point sources, things like farm runoff. How big a deal are municipal wastewater supplies when it comes to getting phosphorus into our waterways?
Well, as usual, the answer is that it depends. Of course, it depends on the treatment plan, and it depends on the receiving water, so the water body that it's discharging into. I think, in general, it's less of a concern for water quality statewide, but there are certain locations where it is much more of a big deal.
Well, I can think of a lot of cities and towns that are right on lakes around Wisconsin, maybe most of them. I don't know. Is that a situation you tend to look at pretty closely?
There's a few where that might be an issue. I'm in Dane County, and our wastewater treatment plant deliberately does not discharge to the lakes that are in Dane County. So it would probably depend on the lake and what other sources of phosphorus may be around the lake, how much agriculture, how many properties have lawns that use fertilizer and that sort of thing.
Before we dig into how wastewater plants treat phosphorus, can you tell us a little bit about the damage done in waterways when there's a lot of phosphorus, regardless of the source of it?
Absolutely. So phosphorus is a critical component of cells. So when algae grow, they need the phosphorus in order to reproduce. And so if you give them more, they will happily reproduce more, which is why we get really serious algae blooms in lakes and other waters that have a lot of phosphorus. So there is a focus on decreasing the amount of phosphorus going into lakes and rivers specifically to control the algae blooms. And in the case of the Mississippi River, Wisconsin has a commitment to reducing the load of phosphorus that goes into the Gulf of Mexico, where we also see serious algae blooms that then cause the famous dead zone. And so the phosphorus really is sort of secondary to the problem that it causes. The algae are the problem, but the phosphorus is almost in every situation the primary control or the primary determinant of how much algae you get.
So less phosphorus, less algae and cyanobacteria, healthier water. Is that path?
Yep.
And now let's get into how communities' wastewater plants remove phosphorus. How do they do it? How does that work?
Well, there's a couple of different options that wastewater treatment plants have, and we characterize them or group them based on whether they're mainly biological, so whether they use microorganisms to remove the phosphorus, or if they use chemicals to remove the phosphorus. And many plants use a combination. So the biological process is cheaper. Some people consider it to be more environmentally friendly because you use fewer chemicals and usually less energy, and you generate less waste. But the biological process often does not remove enough of the phosphorus. So it can remove a lot, but only to a certain amount, a certain level. And then you need to treat the water with chemicals in order to remove the additional phosphorus. And even then, if you need to reduce the phosphorus below the approximate 1 milligram per liter limit or 1 part per million limit, you have to add a filtration system. And so many treatment plants in Wisconsin have a biological process coupled to a chemical process, but without the filtration. And so it's the filters that need to be added to the wastewater treatment plant to reach that lower limit of 0.1 milligrams per liter that often is the largest, dollar investment needed to get to that lower standard.
As I understand it, that standard you're talking about will be in full effect in Wisconsin in 2025. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I actually shouldn't comment much on the timing of that because I'm not very familiar with it. I think it may depend also wastewater treatment plant to wastewater treatment plant because each treatment plant has a permit for discharge that gets renewed at a different time. And so the Wisconsin DNR is gradually, renewing those permits. And each time they renew a permit, the wastewater treatment plant has to potentially meet a different water quality goal.
We're talking to Trina McMahon, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Bacteriology at UW-Madison, about phosphorus in our water and the city and town side of the equation, how phosphorus can be removed at wastewater treatment plants. Trina, phosphorus, when used in agriculture, is pretty helpful stuff, as I understand it. Can we take the phosphorus we remove from the water in a wastewater treatment plant and use it again for a positive purpose?
Absolutely, and this is an active area of research at many universities in collaboration with wastewater treatment plants, including our local treatment plant here in Madison. You can remove the phosphorus chemically, and there are ways to separate the solid material that's produced, and then repurpose that into fertilizer. Of course, we don't need phosphorus fertilizer on many of the land in parts of Wisconsin that already have plenty of phosphorus in the soil. But there are locations that need phosphorus fertilizer, and certainly outside of Wisconsin there are many places that do. And so the concept of shipping the phosphorus out of a watershed and to a place where it's more needed is a very interesting one. Globally, we are anticipating a phosphorus shortage because in parts of the world where phosphorus is not present in abundance in the soil, it needs to be mined, and the phosphorus rock that is used for that purpose is running out. And so there's this prediction that at some point we're going to be in a crisis state where we don't have enough phosphorus to fertilize the crops that need to feed the world. And so the idea that we could recover it from our waste and eventually, use that to meet the need is a very compelling one. And when we think about sort of waste to resource recovery systems, sort of a more sustainable model for using our elements of our waste to repurpose into useful, needed products.
Now, where we've been focusing on wastewater treatment, can you look at some of the easiest ways, maybe the low-hanging fruit when it comes to getting phosphorus from farm runoff and keeping that from getting into waterways?
Yeah, that's, a subject that I don't know as much about, but I know that there are what people refer to as best management practices for agricultural runoff. And many of these practices were developed at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Agricultural Engineering or Biological Systems Engineering program. And those include things like bioswales, so these are like mounds basically that intercept the water or block the water from going directly into a stream or a river. Wetland restoration is a big deal because the phosphorus can be immobilized by the plants and other biological activity in a wetland. So as we remove or drain wetlands, it exacerbates the problem of phosphorus going directly into the water. Here in Dane County, there are efforts to actually dredge certain waterways that are rich in phosphorus, so dealing with the phosphorus after it's already gotten, away from the farm and is now sort of sitting there in the river waiting for a flood event to deliver it to the lake. So I think the issue with non-point source pollution is that you have to try or implement many different strategies because it's such a heterogeneous or, different from place to place. And so it depends a lot on what the topography of the farm is and what the river looks like and those sorts of things. Whereas at a wastewater treatment plant, it's usually pretty straightforward of, you have a pipe and there's stuff coming out of the pipe and you need to reduce that by putting another filter or something on the pipe before it goes, right?
I want to end up with a science nerdy kind of question and looking at the biological part of wastewater treatment when it comes to getting phosphorus out. Who are our biological buddies that help take phosphorus out of the water in this system?
Oh, boy, that's like my favorite subject to talk about in the whole world. we have bacteria that do that job for us. Not very many people know this, but almost all of our sewage in the United States is treated and cleaned up by bacteria. And so there are very special bacteria that store phosphorus inside their cells, so in their bodies. And we, as engineers, have developed processes that help them to maximize that. So we can grow the bacteria in a certain way to sort of convince them to take as much phosphorus out of the water as they can. And again, it's a very specialized group of bacteria, and so many people study those bacteria to find a way to make them store it even better.
And what happens to those bacteria when they're done storing that phosphorus?
Well, bacteria in wastewater treatment plants actually stick together very well, and so if enough of them stick together, they form a chunk. We call them a flock, and they can just settle out of the water or sort of fall out of the water by gravity. And so most wastewater treatment plants just use a big tank, and they hold the bacteria in the tank and keep them still, and then the particles of bacteria settle to the bottom where they can be pumped off and treated separately. And actually, those bacteria can be a very concentrated source of phosphorus into the system that then repurposes the phosphorus for fertilizer. So the biological treatment method is very amenable to the resource recovery or phosphorus recovery strategy for that reason.
Cool. Trina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's like one of my favorite things to talk about. It's very fun.
Trina McMahon is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering and bacteriology at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about the technology used to remove phosphorus at wastewater treatment plants and other sources like farm fields. New water quality standards going into effect in Wisconsin in 2025 will tighten some of the regulations on phosphorus.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a congressional reporter about efforts in Congress aimed at ending the government shutdown. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, we'll get a recap of last night's State of the State address.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Congress is still looking for a solution to the ongoing government shutdown. President Trump's personal lawyer is walking back comments he made related to the special counsel's investigation into the Trump campaign.
And the president is getting criticized by lawmakers for remarks aimed at Senator Elizabeth Warren.
We want to hear your thoughts on Congress and the shutdown at 800-642-1234. Is there a compromise you want to see to bring this to an end? Should Democrats agree to vote on bills even if they include border wall money? Should President Trump set aside his demands and agree to fund the government? Do you see one side as ultimately responsible for keeping the shutdown going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Dan Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Dan, let's start with the latest on the government shutdown. It sounds like party leaders in the Senate have agreed to vote on a couple of bills tomorrow that could end the shutdown. What's being brought up for a vote?
Well, to say that they could end the shutdown is a very optimistic point of view at this point. These seem to be increasingly looking like show votes that are not expected to pass. There's two bills. One is a three-week continuing resolution that would basically reopen the government at current funding levels for 3 weeks and give negotiators time to try to work out a deal. Maybe cooler heads will prevail in that time, and we could reopen the government on more of a long-term basis. The other one is becoming more controversial by the day. This is it tracks with President Trump's the deal that he outlined in the speech that he recently gave, and it was reported at the time that this was going to be a sort of a short-term fix for the so-called dreamers and for people who have temporary protective status. But now, the devil is in the details. What this bill really does, it makes certain reforms to these programs that Democrats are very unhappy with at this point.
And as you stated, President Trump had proposed a temporary reprieve on deportation for those in the DACA program in exchange for border wall money. So let's take a listen to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer addressing that yesterday.
Now, the president said his proposal was a reasonable compromise. In fact, it is neither reasonable nor a compromise. There was no serious negotiation with any Democrat about what went into the proposal. That's because the proposal was never intended to pass. It's only a thinly veiled attempt by the president to save face. Anyone who looks at the legislation can tell it was designed to fail.
Dan, do you expect the rest of the Democratic caucus to hold that view as well? Or could there be some that break away and consider accepting smaller concessions from the president?
Well, there could be some, but I don't think there will be enough for this thing to pass. If you look at some of the details, it's not a straight short-term extension of or reprieve, as you put it, for Dreamers. What it does is it would make the Dreamers have to reapply, and it would bar any new applicants, people who aren't already in the pipeline, from applying. And it adds higher hurdles, like it would require for Dreamers who are not students to be at 125% of the poverty line. So those who are poor essentially wouldn't be eligible for this. And there would be additional fines added on the temporary protective status. It takes away the status from Nepal, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, and Sudan, and adds some of the same hurdles that I just mentioned. Not to mention that, it reforms the asylum system. Anybody who comes from Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador seeking asylum would be sent home without exception, which actually flies in the face of international law. So there's a lot of things that people can point to here, who Democrats can point to here, to give them a reason not to vote for it. That said, if they want to vote for it, it could be a sort of an inoculation against a further political attack down the road. It does include $12.7 billion in disaster aid funding. And people from some of those states who, that need that funding may be inclined to support this, for those reasons. But just on the details of the immigration side of it, I'm not sure that's going to be very enticing for Democrats.
Dan Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal, and we are talking about this week's news in Washington, including the government shutdown. Now, early in this whole shutdown debacle, there were bipartisan measures to fund the government without a border wall, but those wouldn't get signed by President Trump. Is he still the lone holdout here, or are Republican lawmakers voting more in his image or going along with what he wants recently?
I think the general trend is that Republican lawmakers will not go along with anything that the president will not sign. That's the general trend. There have been a couple of people who have peeled off here and there, and some moderate Republicans in the House mostly have voted for some of these piecemeal bills to reopen the government. And again, it seems mostly for political reasons, because they will be the most vulnerable members in the elections in 2 years, and they don't want to have this as a stain on their record. But I think this really comes down to, in my estimation, two people, Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been very clear that he wants $5.7 billion, if not more, for a physical border barrier. And Nancy Pelosi has said that the border barrier is a non-starter. Now, the latest on Pelosi's position, some of her deputies have been floating $5.7 billion, which is the same money that the president wants, but they are floating that to pay for what they're calling a smart wall, things like technology, like drones along the border, more agents, more immigration judges to expedite proceedings down there, but anything but a physical barrier, which they think is a waste of money and just frankly wouldn't work and wouldn't be feasible in a lot of parts of the border, whether it be because there are private landowners, national parks, state parks, and other things that are impediments to actually building there. So we'll see how that's received. That just came out today. But again, if Trump doesn't move away from the position of having a physical barrier, I'm not sure how this thing gets this thing gets solved.
We want to hear your thoughts on Congress and the shutdown. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Kevin in Deerfield. Good afternoon, Kevin. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Thank you. I thought the way things were supposed to work was if the president has an initiative, a policy initiative, or a budget item that they want, they make a proposal to Congress, and Congress either votes it up or down. And I don't remember President Obama didn't get everything he wanted for the Affordable Care Act, but he didn't shut the government down over it. What's the difference here?
Kevin, thank you so much for the call. What is the difference, Dan?
Well, a lot of times, most times when you're making policy, you start with committee hearings and you examine the issue, you have experts in, and then you put together legislation, whether that be, from the chairman of the committees or with leadership's input or the other way around, and then you pass that, and of course the White House will have say in it, but ultimately the policy is largely driven by members of Congress, and you corral votes and you pass it, and it gets to the president's desk, and it's not going to be everything that the president wants. Often, but you make compromises. I mean, the art of crafting legislation is the art of compromise. Here in this case, as I mentioned, just a second ago, that we are at a position where what the president wants and what Democrats are willing to pass are complete opposites, and it just does not seem. It seems to put it one way, there's a wall between. Between the two sides that they're just not able to get through.
Now, Republicans had control of both houses of Congress until the midterm elections. What got in the way of approving wall funding at that time?
Part of it is that it wouldn't have passed in the Senate. They would have needed 60 votes, which would include some Democrats, to pass that. There had been a lot of reporting throughout that period that President Trump had pushed for it. Speaker Ryan at that time and Leader McConnell had told him, well, we'll do it next time, we'll do it next time. Now it seems that the Democrats have taken over the chamber, and President Trump is fed up with the lack of action on it and has decided that now is the time to make his mark.
We're talking with Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal, looking at some of the week's big political news.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Weigh in on the shutdown. How do you want it to end? Should it end soon? Are you hopeful? And here's a question. Do you think a State of the Union address should be delivered to Congress and the nation during the shutdown? Speaker Pelosi and President Trump have different and opposite answers to that question. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Right now, we continue the conversation with Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent at the National Journal, looking at some of the week's big political news. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have a question or a statement for Dan, not only about the government shutdown, but other news in this week in Washington. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Julie, in Partyville. Good afternoon, Julie. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Here's my question. I recently was reading an article, I believe it was USA Today, about the shutdown, and it stated that 420,000 federal workers are going to be working because they're essential workers, and they're not going to get their paychecks, of course, until something is signed and the budget is approved. But there are 380,000 workers who aren't working, and appropriations were signed to pay them back pay when the shutdown ends. My question is, what's the logic in that? If we're going to pay these 380,000 workers for not working anyway, why don't we just keep them working and keep our national parks open and so forth?
Julie, thanks for the call. Dan, what is your response to Julie's question?
Well, the short answer is that it's against the law to do so. You cannot I guess, cause people to work without getting paid, without an appropriation, unless they are considered essential workers. Largely, those are workers who whose jobs have to do with national security and other things that are deemed essential, like that. But it is true. It does seem sort of pointless and disjointed that you're going to send people home and lose all that productivity and lose all the good work that people could be doing, but pay them anyway. Of course, the other side of that is you could not pay them. That would be incredibly disruptive to people who work for the federal government, and really that's just bad business.
Now, both President Trump and the Democrats have said they're not going to budge on their positions. Is this ultimately going to come down to both sides calculating the political costs of not compromising?
Well, I wish I could tell you. You know, I've covered a couple of these shutdowns before, and there always seems like a logical way out. It seems like at the end there's a compromise position that could be had, or something that somebody's asking for seems a bridge too far, and they're going to have to give it up at some point. But in this case, it's just hard to predict because it relies so much on the whims of President Trump. Is he going to keep holding out for this wall or not? Does he believe that the public sentiment is turning against him or not? Who is he trying to do this, for whose benefit? Is it for his conservative base? Is it for national security? Does he care that his general approval ratings are plummeting from the mid-40s right now, according to some polling, down into the 30s? So really, I think it depends so much on one person that it's just hard to predict.
Let's take another phone call in regards to the shutdown. Let's go to Justin in Sun Prairie. Good afternoon, Justin. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Did you have a question for Dan?
Well, I wonder if it's more of a question or more of a statement, but Dan, I have to tell you, I'm married to a federal employee. We're directly affected in our household by this shutdown. I have she is reluctant to be any kind of face of this, but I've reached out repeatedly, whether it's through social media channels or by email or on the phone. I contacted Ron Johnson at his Oshkosh, Madison, Milwaukee, and Washington, D.C. offices today to express my concern about federal workers who I feel are maybe some of the best patriots, maybe some of the best representatives of people that care about the workings of our government in this country, and how they're being used and manipulated as pawns by this president. And I feel helpless. I feel like representative democracy has maybe lost its meaning. And I just feel really, really discouraged that it has a direct impact on our household, and I know many others. And I feel like, why is the issue of security on the border, which has been going on for decades, how is that a national crisis now? How is that tied to the livelihood of federal workers and their families? And I guess that's my question is, why are these issues being related? Why are we being used as pawns in Donald Trump's egotistical power play to relate his name to a wall?
Justin, thank you for the call. Dan, your response.
Yeah, Justin, I'm so sorry to hear about what you're going through, and you're correct to be angry. This has been a tactic that has been more prevalent in recent years to try to shut down the government to try to extract concessions from the other side. And the reason that happens is because there's only so many so-called must-pass bills that Congress has to pass every year, and the most surefire one is an appropriations bill. So certain members or parties, or in some cases even a president, can say, I'm not going to approve this bill unless you put something else on it. And so there's a hard deadline there. It's leverage, basically. And really the name of the game here is leverage. And it's really unfortunate that so many hundreds of thousands of workers are being caught up in this really what is a political fight. You have every right to be frustrated by that, and you should continue reaching out to your members of Congress and senators to let them know how you feel.
Dan, can you address the back and forth on the State of the Union between State of the Union address between President Trump and Speaker Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah, so now this ceremonial speech is being drawn into this this political food fight, too. Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump are they really don't seem to get along, to put it mildly. We saw that on full display a couple weeks ago when Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer visited the White House. But now they're kind of using the powers that they have against each other. So Nancy Pelosi is trying to hit Trump where, in her estimation, where it hurts. Take away his TV time. Take away the part of the year where all eyes will be on him and everybody has to listen to what he says. In a response, Donald Trump took away a delegation flight that she was going to take to Afghanistan to visit troops and said that, you need to stay here and negotiate. I'm not going to approve this airfare. Really, it seems, this fight is being fought on another plane here.
Now, moving on to the Mueller investigation, Rudy Giuliani, a member of President Trump's legal team, has had a lot to say this week about talks Trump had with his former attorney, Michael Cohen, about a development project in Moscow. But he's had to walk back some of those comments. Can you remind folks what he's been saying?
Yeah, so Rudy Giuliani was on television, and he said that some of these talks went on well into 2016. He said sometime in October, November 2016, which would have been well into, if not beyond, the campaign and election. Now, he of course, walked that back, I mean, because it would be inappropriate, to say the least, for a campaigning president to try to negotiate with a foreign adversary a business deal during a campaign. This has become a part of what's being asked about on TV, in part because of a BuzzFeed report citing law enforcement sources that said Trump directly asked his one-time lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about that communication. And that would, of course, be a huge deal because that is a federal crime, and lawmakers have already come out and said that if that's true, that would be an impeachable offense. But now there is some question about whether or not it is true. A spokesman for Robert Mueller, the special counsel, said parts of the story are not accurate. Which parts? We don't know. So that's where we stand on that. And Michael Cohen was set to testify early next month in front of the House Oversight Committee, where members wanted to ask him directly, did the president at that time, the nominee for the Republicans, directly tell you or ask you to lie to Congress? But now Cohen has postponed his testimony because Giuliani and Trump are threatening him and his family. So this is really getting ugly, getting dirty, and there are more questions than there are answers.
Dan, we have about a minute and a half left, so I wanted to ask you about the president's tweet last week about one of his political foes, Senator Elizabeth Warren. He once again referred to her as Pocahontas and suggested she film campaign commercials from Wounded Knee. Can you tell us a little bit about the reaction that got?
Well, this comes right as the first Native American women ever elected to Congress were seated just this month. And one of those women, Deb Haaland, is considering bringing up some sort of legislation to express her disapproval of those remarks, which she considers to be extremely racist. She says that he's using the names of Native American women as racial slurs. Now, whether this is going to be a condemnation in a full force or more of a slighter, which is called a resolution of disapproval, we don't know yet. But it seems those comments have really not gone over well over here on Capitol Hill.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
Dan Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. He was with us for a look at some of the week's top news in national politics. So there's still time for you to share your thoughts on the government shutdown. Should House Democrats agree to vote on a bill that includes wall funding? Should the wall issue be addressed separately from other spending? Let us know what you think. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. You can also go to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Send us your thoughts on the government shutdown.
Here's a follow-up to a conversation we had last week. We talked about how people are celebrating life events in more and more public ways. A big example of that is the gender reveal party, where people come up with more and more elaborate ways to say whether they're having a boy or a girl.
Now, we saw this in the news today. A chain of Italian-style restaurants is getting in on the game. They've released a line of gender reveal lasagna. It looks like normal lasagna on top, but when you cut into it, the insides are either pink or blue.
So, yeah, oh, is it a boy or a girl? I don't know. Well, let's have some lasagna while we wait to find. Oh, it's pink. It's a girl. All right. There's a lot of problems here. First of all, you like lasagna, right, Darrell?
I love lasagna. It's one of my favorite foods.
Okay. How about lasagna and you cut it open and it's pink or blue?
I can't do it.
Right.
I even though it's probably food coloring. I'm sure that's what it is. The thought of cutting into it and having it either pink or blue, I can't get with that. I can't eat it.
Right. So I say, you know, if you want to give me lasagna, great. I'll eat the lasagna and then just say it's a boy or it's a girl. I don't
exactly.
care. And I really don't care. You're having a baby. Lovely. I'm going to get the baby a present. It's going to be like a book or a Packers jersey. It can be a boy present. It can be a girl present. I don't care which one it is, honestly.
I agree with you. Cake. It can be pink or blue.
Cake.
I don't care.
Yeah.
Lasagna.
Food coloring. Lasagna.
Yeah.
I don't want pink or blue lasagna.
Can't do it.
And now you know this. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.